Well, you can't grapple with the book of James and avoid the uncomfortable issue which has made our passage this morning perhaps the most theologically disputed of the letter. And indeed, verse 24, possibly the most disputed and controversial verse in the book. A person is justified by what he does, and not by faith alone. Well, hold on. Hold on. That doesn't seem to sit very comfortably with Paul in Romans 3:28, does it? A person is justified by faith, says Paul, apart from observing the law. Here's the elephant in the room in the book of James. Here is the territory that led the great Martin Luther, grappling as he was with the abuses of the medieval church, to call James an epistle of straw. Are James and Paul contradicting one another? Saying fundamentally different things about salvation and the Christian life. Oh, we love Paul's message of grace, don't we? We revel in God's verdict of not guilty on us and of his imputing his own righteousness to us in Christ, by faith alone, at the beginning of the Christian life, with nothing else commending us to God. We know that we can never get right with God by doing our best. We know that because our best is never good enough. It's by grace you have been saved, says Paul, through faith. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. And this not from yourselves. It is the gift of God, not by works, he says, so that no one can boast. But here's James seemingly saying that a person is justified by what he does, and not by faith alone. Is he, in Luther's phrase, mangling the scriptures and denying that justification is by faith alone, as the reformers and we believe? Are we forgiven, acquitted, counted righteous because of the work of Christ alone? Or are our good works, in fact, an essential addition to secure God's acceptance of us? Here's the issue. Is there a contradiction at the very heart of the New Testament? Well, no, there's not. And I hope I can do something in the next few minutes to reassure you of that case. Two preliminary points, first of all, we've got to get hold of before we get into looking at what James says. First, Paul and James both teach that every Christian is called to do good works. We are God's workmanship, says Paul in that great Ephesians 2, verse 10, created in Christ Jesus to do good works which God prepared for us in advance to do. We are, says Titus 2, 14, to devote ourselves to doing what is good. So Paul signs up with James to the calling to do good works. There's no question about that. It's a non-negotiable. James in chapter 1 says the same thing. Chapter 1, verse 22 to 25, we're to be not just listeners, but doers, doers of the word. The entire New Testament demands a change of conduct if someone professes to be in Christ Jesus. And then second, there's a problem about language. Because James and Paul each use some important words in slightly different contexts. Now, it's the 4th of July, and I hope you may be in touch with some of your American friends, or you may speak to some of your American friends here. But if you're a Brit and an American talks to you about football, or if perhaps you're on slightly more intimate terms and they mention pants, there's just a moment. There's just a moment when you need to pause to check that you're talking about precisely the same things. You may not be. You see, when James uses the word faith, he's thinking principally of an intellectual assent that makes no difference to conduct. As we'll see in a moment, even demons have that sort of faith, he says. When Paul speaks of faith, he means something completely different. He means the attitude whereby a person entrusts their whole life and future to Christ. When James uses the word justify, he's using it in the sense of vindicate, validate, authenticate, demonstrate. He brings us examples, and he says, here is conduct which demonstrates or confirms that this is real faith. When Paul, on the other hand, uses the word justify, he refers to a person being declared righteous. As Thomas Manton, the Puritan, wrote, in Paul's sense, a sinner is absolved. In James's sense, a believer is approved. And when James commends what he calls works, he's speaking of those actions in the lives of Christians which spring from new life in Christ. Paul has no problem with that. He says exactly the same thing. No, Paul's issue is one of reliance on the works of the law done by human sweat to gain us salvation. And that's a completely different thing to what James is talking about. That's not the problem James is addressing. Those sort of works won't, can't ever justify us in Paul's sense. Well, those are the essential preliminaries to get hold of straight away. Paul knew very well, you know, that his teaching about grace often got people confused and it led to serious distortion. And he addresses that in places like Romans 6, as you know, verses 1 and 2. Shall we go on sinning so that grace may abound or increase? By no means, he says. Well, James has been misunderstood too. A verse that has helped me as much as any in this so-called conflict between Paul and James has been Galatians 5:6. And it's worth, if you don't mind, just glancing back at that. 1171. Galatians 5:6. It's a great verse to get hold of in this debate. Here is Paul. For in Christ Jesus neither circumcision nor uncircumcision has any value. Listen to this. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself, or as the RSV has it, working through love. Faith expressing itself or working through love. You see that? Question, Paul, what is the only thing that counts with God? Answer, faith. Question, but what kind of faith, Paul? Answer, faith that works through love. That's the only kind of faith that the New Testament is interested in. What counts with God is not faith plus a layer of works added to faith. No, it's the kind of faith which by its very nature produces love. Faith alone, always, is the only thing that gives us our right standing with God. But the love that comes from it and with it shows that it's the real thing. That it's living, justifying, authentic faith. And this is precisely James's theme. Loveless faith is absolutely useless. It just can't be the real thing. And anyone who comes along and says, I've been justified by faith alone, and so I don't need to be a loving person to get to heaven, isn't telling the truth. They're wrong. James is concerned with counterfeit faith, the sort that doesn't produce love. And he's pretty blunt, verse 14. What good is it, brothers, fellow Christians, if someone claims to have faith but has no deeds? Can such faith save him? Well, you see his concern. Can that sort of faith save him? No, it can't. Somebody says, I'm a Christian. James says, produce the evidence. What kind of works is James interested in? Why, he's interested in exactly the same kind of works that Paul is interested in. Signs that you mean business with God in your faith. Works of love, real faith, saving faith changes your behavior. It makes you a different person. Well, now let's see how James unpacks this in four little scenarios. And he does it very neatly. He begins with hyperbole. He moves on to irony. He then takes a venerable example. And then he finishes with an incredible example. Let's take a moment or two on each of those. And they're all to get his one message across. There's the message in verse 17. Faith without works, faith not accompanied by action, is dead. Couldn't be blunter. Well, let's look at each. First little scenario is there in verses 15 to 17. And it's what we might call colloquially a no-brainer. Verse 15. Someone in the fellowship, a brother or a sister, is destitute, without clothes and daily food. And the brother, the sister, the person supposed to be the Christian, has good intentions, yes, laces them with a few pious platitudes. Verse 16, go, I wish you well, all the best, I'll pray for you. All the sort of things that we say. But end of verse 16, see the problem? Does nothing about his physical needs. What good is that? Asks James. Here's someone who's a Christian, they say. And in his own spiritual family, here is someone in dire need. And he makes the right noises and he says the right things, but he does nothing. His emotions are not stirred enough to take him out of his comfort zone. His words speak grace, but they utterly fail to minister it. He's theologically straight, but spiritually empty. He believes the right things and says the right things. He makes the right noises, but there's no action. There's no delivery. There's no doing. Hasn't changed his life. What good is this faith? Asks James rhetorically. No good at all, we mutter. It's blindingly obvious. He's hopeless. He's a rotter. And this, says James, is not, as we might have said, you know, a half faith, a sort of faith, an impaired faith. No, verse 17, it's dead faith. There's such an entity in the New Testament as dead faith. And it's not ultimately masked by saying the right things. In the second little scenario, verses 18 to 20, he moves to irony. Because there's not just dead faith, there is, secondly here, devil faith. You see that? James pictures an imaginary interrupter, a theological wise guy who corners him, verse 18. Someone will say, you have faith, I have deeds, trying to be theologically clever. There is a faith that even devils have, says James, verse 19. You believe there is one God? Good. Even the demons believe that and shudder. James's serious message here is that even orthodox doctrine alone, believing the right things, will not themselves save you. See, devils can be orthodox at the intellectual level. Devils believe many truths about God. As the hymn writer, Rock of Ages fame, Augustus Toplady, wrote of his 18th century clergy colleagues, the devils are incomparably more orthodox than 19 in 20 of our modern divines. Mental assent won't do by itself. It's not enough. You can't just be a Christian in your head. Think of Simon Magus in Acts chapter 8, believing many things, and yet, as Acts 8:23 tells us, with a heart full of bitterness, captive to sin. Or Judas Iscariot, a person extraordinarily close to Jesus, with him day after day for years, and yet not connected, a believer with a dishonest heart. See, assent to truth, without true affection for Jesus and his people, is, verse 20, a faith without deeds, and it is useless. It's faith without love. Dead faith, devil faith. And remember Jesus' solemn words in Matthew 7:22 and 23. He speaks of the many, who on the day of judgment will say that they knew him, and who'll big up their efforts in all sorts of different ways, and he'll say, depart from me, I never knew you. And it's a solemn word. Well, it's a relief then to turn to our third little cameo, to James's venerable example. Because having done his demolition job on mere profession of faith, professions of faith which lack all credibility because there's no change of life. There's no love. There's no manifestation. He turns to the mighty Abraham. And what a coincidence that James makes his case for dynamic faith from the life of Abraham, while Paul does precisely the same thing in Romans 4 for his case. Reassuringly to me, Abraham is the model for both of them. And that's an encouragement, isn't it? James takes two events from the life of Abraham. First, in verse 23, he quotes Genesis 15, verse 6, God's promise to Abraham to have a host of descendants, which Abraham accepts and stands on despite the age of his wife and so on. He believed the Lord, and it was credited to him as righteousness. That's exactly what Paul does with the same verse in Romans chapter 4 and verse 3, which we read. One thing is reckoned as righteousness, faith. But James takes it a little bit further. And James notices, verse 21, that in Genesis 22, 1 to 19, God had tested Abraham. Everybody knew the story of Isaac very well. It was at the heart of Jewish understanding and tradition and teaching. It was a big event. And James picks it up. What was God testing? Well, he was testing Abraham's faith. What was he looking for in the Isaac story? Well, he was looking for the kind of obedience that counts when the chips are down. The obedience that says, I'll do it, I'll do it. I'll act as God wills. Living faith that produces the obedience of faith. Not just deedless assent, but active devotion. Faith that's full of commitment and passion and that unreservedly abandons life to God's plans and purposes. In Genesis 15, Abraham said he believed God. In Genesis 22, Abraham showed he believed God. And that's what verse 24 confirms. What Abraham did unmistakably authenticated the faith that had saved him. And God said as much to Abraham. If you look at Genesis 22, verse 12, God says, Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld your only son. It's a test. And Abraham comes through it with flying colors. And James here is speaking of the evidence of Abraham's saving faith. It's all about evidence. And the only evidence that counts is action for God, which holds nothing back. Yes, we're saved by faith alone. But as Calvin wonderfully puts it, the faith that saves is never alone. It's always zealous for good works. Paul's great theme is that nobody can procure salvation by the works of the law, what we do. James's great theme is that nobody can prove their salvation except by works of love, how we live. Both use Abraham as their best example. Dead faith, devil faith, dynamic faith. The final little picture of active faith that seems almost incredible, verses 25 and 26. Rahab the prostitute. We're not quite expecting this one. Abraham's a massive figure. She's a bit player. He's a man. She's a woman. He's a patriarch. She's a prostitute. He's the father of the chosen. She's a foreigner. He's respected. She's disreputable. You can read her story, Joshua chapter 2. It's a great story. And it comes to this. Simply, she laid her life on the line to care for those who weren't even related to her. She ran enormous personal risks, you remember, for the spies, because she had faith in their God. In a very real sense, her faith and action saved her. Verse 25, it was validated by what she did. She believed God. She believed in the coming judgment. She identified with the people of God and then put her neck on the line. She's honored for it in Hebrews 11 and finds herself in the opening verses of the New Testament as an ancestor of the Messiah, Rahab the prostitute. See, it doesn't matter how seedy or ugly or shameful you feel your own past may be. It doesn't really matter even how you got into the Christian faith in the first place. The only thing that matters at the moment is, are you a believer in the Lord, and are you showing that by the way you live every day? Rahab could not be more different, could she, to the creep of verse 15. The armchair philanthropist. Because Rahab, you see, puts home, resources, ingenuity, personal safety, the lot, at the disposal of the people of God. And that's dramatic faith. That's saving faith. That's what it looks like when it's real. Well, time has gone. James is frighteningly practical. Questions he leaves are hard-hitting, and they're quite personal. Is my faith a dynamic faith or a dead faith? It could be either. It's got to be more than just some past transaction between me and God when I made a commitment to him and he to me. It's about, surely, a life of consecration now. It's about obedience which doesn't hold back or want to hold back. James says mature faith is easy to see. It's easy to see because it works. It makes a life different, loving, others-centered. James says to each of us quite bluntly, don't talk the talk unless you're walking the walk. Don't claim to know God unless your life is showing it. Don't be a hearer only, as he put it in chapter 1. Be a doer, starting wherever there's something to be done in the Christian family in the first instance. You may know that telling little jingle. We could do well to ask ourselves, what kind of church would my church be if every member were just like me? Do you believe that Christ is the Lord of your life? Good, good. What do you do that you would not do if you didn't believe it? Do you believe that human beings are precious in God's image? Good, good. What difference is that actually making in your home or at work to the love you show, the colleague you are, the husband you want to be, the father, the daughter, the son you are? You believe that one day you'll answer to Christ who sees and knows all things at the judgment? Good, good. What sin does that restrain you from committing now? You're justified by faith and trusting Christ for salvation? Good. What difference would there be in your everyday life and behavior if that went true? Luther may have had issues about the book of James. He certainly did. But by the time he got to write his own preface to Romans, he'd got this part of James 2 spot on. I quote him as I close. Oh, it is a living, busy, active, mighty thing, this faith. It is impossible for it not to be doing good things incessantly. It does not ask whether good works are to be done. But before the question is asked, it has already done this and is constantly doing them. Whoever does not do such works, however, is an unbeliever. He gropes and looks around for faith and good works, but knows neither what faith is nor what good works are. Yet he talks and talks and talks with many words about faith and good works. James says there's one authenticating sign. Our active, loving, sustained, sleeves rolled up, unconditional service of one another is the only thing that authenticates us as Christian people. Without that, James says, our faith is dead.